Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Barbara Norris, and I represent Dr. Colleen Murphy. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. May it please the court. Plaintiff appellant Dr. Colleen Murphy asked this court to reverse the dismissal of this matter by the Court of Federal Claims and demand for trial. First, the lower court erred in dismissing this matter under Rule 12b-1 for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. This court in Palmer Fisher, in Matt's line of cases, has made it clear that once jurisdiction.
So it's your position, just to interrupt, it's your position that it couldn't have been done under 12b-1. What about 12b-6? Are you saying
that? Well, 12b-6 requires that once extrinsic evidence is admitted and not rejected by the court, then it has to be considered under Rule 56, summary judgment standards.
Okay, so you have, under Rule 56, you would have to persuade us here. There's some question of that that's yet to be decided.
Exactly.
And what is that? What are that? What is that, or what are those?
Well, I have to persuade you that there's a question of fact, but the burden is on the other side to persuade you that there's no question of fact. And
but,
that,
but let's just get to
it. All right, I'll move right in.
What are the factual issues that need to be resolved?
It is your obligation to establish that the that this was not voluntary.
Right. The critical issue in this case is whether the separation was legally voluntary or involuntary. Legal involuntariness is determined by all the facts and circumstances and not simply the fact that she signed a letter requesting separation.
Now, in the opposition to the government's motion to dismiss, and I realize that was a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction and not technically a motion for summary judgment, but nonetheless, you submitted outside evidence beyond the pleadings.
Yes, so did they.
And those materials were admitted.
Yes.
And the government did likewise.
Yes.
But is there anything that you were not permitted to provide?
Well, time restrictions prevented us from having much time to put a case together. In fact, we had requested an extension of time that was only partially granted, and no discovery had been done at all. We filed a complaint. They filed to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. Their motions, we had to respond to their motion with all of our facts, because to me, it appeared that it could be pushed into a summary judgment standard.
Well, that's what I'm getting at, because it seems to me that, I mean, clearly you recognized the issue was the voluntariness of
yes.
the separation, and you responded with information. So the question is, if given the state of flux of our precedent and the subsequent Mets decision, to what extent were you not provided the opportunity to provide additional information, or perhaps more clearly, what information is it that you have to proffer that would be significant that you didn't proffer?
Well, we don't have any more information to proffer now than we did, other than a document from the Inspector General indicating a serious concern about the lack of reporting to the National Practitioner Data Bank, which we would introduce if we were sent back.
If that means that the record is as complete as it will be, then it seems to me that we are in a position to review this as if this was considered on a motion for summary judgment, and then simply examine de novo whether there were clearly erroneous findings of fact, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to your client.
And I guess my only drawback to that is that since we've never had actual discovery in this case, and sometimes discovery leads to important information that can assist you in a case.
Well, that's what I'm asking for. What kind of discovery would you see?
Well, we've never taken the deposition of any of these people. But right now, the the course of conduct as alleged by Dr. Murphy is essentially unrebutted by the other side. So we have a fairly clear history of these actions
that we consider
to be retaliatory.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but there's a lot of background recited in your brief, but a lot of it seems to me is not relevant to the real question, and that is the voluntariness of the separation and whether this whether the separation was coerced and
all the other
factors that are relevant.
We consider that an otherwise voluntary separation can be rendered involuntary if it's obtained under duress or coercion. And coercion consists of the government's failure to follow its own rules, in this case, was its own rule against retaliatory conduct.
But is there not an element in terms of establishing constructive discharge that your client or a person, the alleged victim here, had no other choice but to resign? And if you agree that's an element, what in all of the information you've given us, even all getting all of the inferences, accepting everything you say is correct and true, goes to the point that she had no other choice but to resign?
Because she had already filed three grievances before she left, that the fact that she'd signed a paper saying that she could be deployed anywhere doesn't relieve the government of its obligation not to have created this retaliatory set of circumstances.
Why didn't she have a choice other than to resign? I mean, she, firstly, with respect to the grievances, my understanding is on the state of the record is that there was at least one grievance that wasn't pursued to conclusion. Am I correct?
She had filed it, but she hadn't received a final response.
Right, so there was a pending grievance. She hadn't exhausted, even if that were.
Right, I mean, I would argue futility there because she filed grievance after grievance for many years, and it was more than clear that no one was going to change their mind about this order that she'd be restationed. But the reason why this court should not consider that she should just suck it up and move is the same reason why this court decided in Carmichael that the Naval Service member should not just agree to use a Social Security number, ID number, that he objected to on religious grounds.
Well, Ms. Moore, so is that really the only few choices she had, was to suck it up and move, or to resign? Doesn't that require us to decide that the grievance procedure had totally broken down? There's no meaningful way for her to grieve this?
Well, she had already grieved it through two levels and been denied. So the question is whether some third party who was never named, because she sent her third grievance out.
Did she grieve this transfer?
Yes. Through level one, through level two, she filed level three, and she didn't get an answer. And then her termination date arrived, and eventually they sent her a letter saying, we're not processing level three because you're no longer a member of the service.
Okay. So your argument hinges on a conclusion that there was nothing further with that grievance procedure that could meaningfully have been done. Right?
Yes.
And if we conclude to the contrary, there was at least some other alternative besides resignation.
Well, I think that you'd have to conclude there was a meaningful possibility that some unnamed third party that was higher than the first two, who were already up in the level, the back east level, was going to reach a different conclusion. And there were also efforts by her to contact her congressman. And I mean, she wrote a letter to everybody that she could think of. So the chances that this third grievance was going to alter the course of things was nil. And
well, we should hardly conclude that. I mean, every negotiated agreement, collective bargaining agreement, possibly in the country, has a step grievance procedure leading to arbitration, but they have, usually have several steps. So you're asking us to say that every subsequent step in grievance procedure we should conclude as a matter of law is meaningless?
No, not as a matter of law, but as a matter of the facts in this case. I mean, she had gone through three levels of grievance on numerous things in here, including her exclusion from clinical practice, her non-transfer with the rest of all the people in her unit. I mean, the retaliatory things that set her up to be in this redeployment situation, she had grieved. She was a member of a protected class, and that was the class of people who had done their duty and tried to report misconduct. And so she was in a protected class of people who had sort of whistleblown in this way. And now it seems that like
But just to ask you about that, because it seems you spend a lot of your brief talking about the conduct before the transfer and using that as sort of retaliation to put her in this protected class. The thing that seems a little incongruous about that in reading it is the ultimate case here, the constructive discharge, the reason that she was under so much duress she had to leave, was because she was being placed out of that environment. I mean, I was reading it and sort of thinking, well, having read how terrible and allegedly terrible the life was for her in her state duty station in Alaska, I thought the conclusion was going to be that it was duress to keep her there. But indeed, what you're complaining about is they were taking her out of that stressful, duressful situation. And
well,
so
to her, I mean, it was adding to her duress because no other person in her department was being transferred out of state. Only she was. And the only reason why she was in that position was that the guys in her department got together and had a meeting and made jokes about how they were going to send her as far away as possible. Now, in the sexual harassment context, the federal courts have said, there's an IRS case in the Ninth Circuit that I can't recall the citation to, but it's not appropriate to move the victim to solve the problem. And in this case, even though moving the victim could provide some relief, so in this case, it can't be considered a benefit to her that she was being transferred to another state, which would require her and her entire family to be uprooted and move.
Do you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Yes, sir.
Okay, fine, let's hear from the governor.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Doug Mickle with the United States, and I represent the Public Health Service in this case with the United States. May it please the Court. We believe that the judgment of the Court of Federal Claims should be affirmed because the record supports the decision of the Court that, in fact, Dr. Murphy's resignation was voluntary.
So you agree that we have to decide this on summary judgment on the
56th, not on the other? Yes, Your Honor. We believe that's
the case. Are there any cases that you can cite to us where this Court might appeal?
There are two cases where a 12b1 has been transformed, and there's one where it has not. I believe it was 12b6 because there was matters not outside of the record reviewed from the research. One is Banks v. Garrett, and the other. The citation there is 901 Fed Second, 1084, 1087 is the jump site. And Moden, a recent case, 404 Fed Second, 1335, which was a tax case from the Court of Federal Claims, where the Court of Appeals found that the trial court did rule for the government to dismiss under 12b1, but determined that that was erroneous and it really was pursuant to 12b6.
Do you have any cases on this?
No, they did not. No, Your Honor.
Question.
I'm sorry.
If we were to assume here for the sake of discussion that the question is whether the grievance process would have produced some different result if pursued to conclusion. That was an important issue. Is that an issue that Ms. Murphy should have been entitled to get some discovery on or not?
Not in this case, Your Honor, we believe, and that's primarily because it deals with an assignment of a member of the Uniformed Services. Absent an allegation of procedural error, in this case, the procedural error alleged is that the agency did not file the standards of conduct and ethical guidelines because she was not treated, quote unquote, fairly, I believe it was in the reply brief. But in that case, when it comes to an assignment of someone in the military, that allegation always could be made by someone in the military that they weren't treated fairly because another peer in the barracks was reassigned while that's, someone else wasn't.
That's not exactly what I'm asking. I mean, you don't disagree, do you, that the test set forth in the Christie case is a relevant test for us to be looking at, do you?
No, we won't get into this.
And that, according to that three-part test, one of the questions associated with whether resignation is voluntary is whether the circumstances permitted no other alternative, right?
Yes.
So if that's something we should look at, and we're looking at this as a Rule 56 matter, the question I'm posing to you was there something to be gained by the claimant getting to take discovery on that point, or is there nothing to be gained because it's a counterfactual and so there's no evidence to find it? You see what I'm trying to find out whether the government thinks or what the government position is with respect to whether Rule 56 requires some discovery here for the benefit of Ms. Murphy on this question of other alternatives.
Well, not in this case, primarily because the Christie case is conjunctive. Let's even assume that there's possible discovery on that point. She still can't demonstrate that the government also violated the other two tests in Christie. Because there clearly was another option here, and as was discussed and Dr. Murphy was informed by Captain Canton saying, if you go, when you do go to your reassignment, you continue the grievance process regarding your assignment. That's at the record at 660.
Well, let me ask you hypothetically. Let's assume she had already exhausted the grievance procedure and lost through the grievance procedure. Would you think the result in this case ought to be different?
Not in this case, because there has not been any showing that there's been a procedural error, and this is especially true given the fact that it deals with a military assignment. And the case law, while it's not true, there's no case law directly on point in this court.
Even if it was clear here, she would hear and she could show there was some procedural error in the transfer. They didn't follow the right procedures, they didn't sign the right form. And let's assume also that she's exhausted the grievance procedure and the grievance is final. Would it still be the government's position that it still was not a constructive discharge because she still had a choice other than to leave voluntarily, that it was still a voluntary accident?
Yes, in this case, because the underlying basis of her complaint with the government is with an assignment. It's not like Carmichael, where Carmichael's choice was, I'm going to be forced to leave the service unless I agree to put a social security number, which is against my religious convictions, on a form. Dr. Murphy, in fact, was encouraged by the government to stay in service. The government didn't write any terms for her resignation. They actually encouraged her to accept the reassignment.
But I don't understand how that distinguishes. I mean, they didn't make her leave the service, but they were relocating her to a different job. Why isn't that comparable to the Carmichael leaving the service? I mean, if you're saying she had a choice other than to leave, why isn't that true in the Carmichael case? He could have left and then grieved it or pursued his relief having resigned it. He didn't have to resign in order to do that.
Well, that's true. Carmichael could have, but the action that Carmichael was complaining of directly affected his resignation. That's not the case here. In this case, she could have followed the grievance process and still moved to her new duty assignment.
So your position, if I'm understanding it right, is that for members of the uniformed service, declining a reassignment can never be viewed as a wrongful course of government action. Is that the bottom line?
I don't want to be tied to never, but for the most part, would say as close to never as I could ever say never, Your Honor. That's very true.
And do you have, you know, authority for that? I'm sure you can make sound public policy arguments for it, but I'm wondering if you have some authority for it.
The case law all comes from the seminal case of Orloff v. Willoughby. There are several cases from the Vietnam Bureau of Court, Wright v. Reeser, we cited those in our brief. Noy v. McNamara out of the Ninth Circuit, Court Right of Court System, excuse me, Second Circuit case. But we do know that there's case law from this court in the Woodward case, which involved a discharge service member prior to the old don't ask, don't tell policy for homosexual conduct. It was a First Amendment challenge that, you know, the maintenance of good order of unit cohesion is a proper basis for reassigning someone. So in this case, let's even assume that all the allegations that Dr. Murphy set forth in our brief are true regarding the poison environment in Alaska. To maintain unit cohesion, the agency could reassign Dr. Murphy. And the record has not been controverted. The fact is that there was no longer a compact between Dr. Murphy and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in Alaska. She was a commissioned officer who, pursuant to her commission, did agree that she would be subject to reassignment based upon the needs of the service. The needs of the service, pursuant to a review board in Washington, 4,000 miles across the country away from Alaska, who made that decision, determined there was a need in New Mexico.
But you would concede, would you not, even if it, let's assume we're wrongful. Let's just take it as a given that ultimately after 10 years of litigation, somebody concludes that it was indeed a wrongful transfer. Would it still be the government's position that that doesn't change the outcome in this case? Because that still wouldn't have given her a basis. She still should have complied with the reassignment. That would raise it to the level of constructive discharge, just because it was wrong.
In this case, she should have complied with her orders and gone. It might have been a different story if she didn't comply and was subject to a court-martial where they definitely were pursuing discharge. But in this case, the government wanted Dr. Murphy to maintain her position in the organization. And with all the other resignation cases in this court and its predecessor, that's not the case. All those other cases deal with a plaintiff who, under some means, is trying to be separated from government service. And in this case, the record shows that the government encouraged Dr. Murphy to stay and work through the process internally. She chose to resign and file this complaint 4 or 5 years after.
In this case, the government filed a motion to dismiss, as I understand it, right after the complaint was filed, before the answer, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's true. I'm sorry.
And now, had the government instead filed a motion for summary judgment, then clearly Dr. Murphy would have had the right to take some discovery and would have had the right to mount a defense to the motion.
Not necessarily. She still would have to show under Rule 56F that there was a material fact and dispute regarding that assignment. And at this point,
she could have requested leave to take some discovery if she felt she needed discovery on that issue before responding.
Assuming we wouldn't oppose that, because at that point, she still has the obligation to come forward and say why she can't respond. And if it's her allegation that I just don't believe the rationale of the decision maker in the Surgeon General's office back in Washington, that is not enough to oppose the Surgeon General regarding the assignment.
She may have all kinds of reasons based on the circumstances of her separation. Where, for one reason or another, she may feel she needs some discovery. And I guess the question in my mind is that we're trying to assess whether there could possibly be any such need for discovery, such that if we rule that on this record we can treat this as a summary judgment motion, I just want to be clear that we're not somehow depriving her of the opportunity to make her case.
We know of no information, and I believe Dr. Murphy's counsel said that they believe that all the information they have is here, but for something they might have discovered in depositions. But that's not the standard for being able to depose an official, especially when it comes when it comes under the umbrella of a military assignment, and especially given the law in this court regarding the presumption of regularity regarding the decisions of agency officials. Subject to your questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Norris, anything in rebuttal?
Well, I think that any presumption about the regularity of the conduct of agency officials has to be in serious question when there's affidavit evidence of a witness at a meeting of agency officials where they all got together and decided completely separate from any normal military procedure or regulation that they're going to vote somebody off the island, essentially. I mean, they got together and voted to try to prevent the tribe from accepting Dr. Murphy and the transfer of the entire rest of her.
Well, let me ask you, and I think this is a little redundant into a question I think Judge Jordan asked you early on, which is that assume hypothetically that our view of the law in this case, the facts of this case, were that given that she had not exhausted the grievance procedure, and we don't think that it was futile, I mean, there's a procedure in place and she hadn't exhausted it, then therefore we can't say that she had no other choice but to resign. What is there in the kind of information you would seek in discovery that could be futile about that? It goes to that, the heart of that question.
I guess in discovery we could try to discover whose decision that would have been and whether they would have decided any differently. But in this moment,
what would you be trying to establish then?
That it would be futile. But I think there's substantial evidence already as to futility. I mean, this wasn't her first grievance. She filed multiple grievances.
But we're not, my question isn't about the merits of that. I'll just hypothetically assume we would, on the state of the record now, we would conclude that. Is there anything more that you can think of that would be available in discovery that goes to that issue?
To the issue of exhaustion remedies?
Yeah, well, I mean, if our conclusion is that she hadn't exhausted her grievance procedure, there's no indication that there's nothing on the record now that established that it would have been futile. And we think, given that, she had a choice other than to resign. Is there anything in discovery that could go in?
Well, I think the discovery would be oriented towards what she theoretically missed by not having had the military, which could have responded to her third grievance promptly and didn't do so, have made some kind of response. But her grievance at level two was denied by the deputy director, I think, of the agency. She had also filed numerous EEO proceedings, which she followed all the way to the bitter end of the Surgeon General. She filed with the Board of Military Corrections 2 years ago, and they've never decided anything. So that's part of the futility.
Ms. Doss, your time has expired. Thank you very much. Mr. Rickle, the case is submitted.